From 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf unveiled his new budget this week with spending up 2.5%.
In my proposed budget, there are no broad-based tax increases.
It attempts to address a $3 billion structural deficit, but are cost savings enough to win Republican support?
We must have cuts and consolidations and reform government, not just consolidate, but reform the policies behind how we spend the money.
With the Democratic primary about 3 months away, Mayor Peduto currently has two challengers. How contentious might the race become?
I suspect probably we will not see the pillars of the Republic crumbling this May.
And the Inspector General reports cheating and misconduct at the State Police Academy. We'll discuss all that on The Confluence, where the news comes together following this news update. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. With about a month ago to file nominating petitions for the primary, Mayor Bill Peduto might have two challengers. Plus, the State Inspector General's office finds cheating at the State Police Academy. That's all coming up later. But first, Governor Wolf this week unveiled his budget proposal for fiscal 2017-18. $32.3 billion, $800 million dollar increase in spending from the budget that was enacted for this year. Joining us to dissect the budget and reaction to key aspects of it, Karen Langley, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Post-Gazette. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And also on the line is Sam Janish, a political reporter for LNP, the daily newspaper in Lancaster County. Sam, welcome.
Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence.
Harrisburg has been living beyond its means. Well, households can't do that, and neither can we.
That's obviously Democratic Governor Tom Wolf addressing the legislature Tuesday. That sentence and some other words, phrases, references, streamlining, consolidating, we might expect to come from a Republican governor or Republican legislative leaders. So is the governor facing the reality of the large structural deficit, or the fact that the GOP has a strong grasp in both the House and Senate? Let's start with Karen.
Hi. Well, I think it's a combination of all these things. You know, we have seen a couple years of really, strenuous disagreement and gridlock here in Harrisburg as Governor Wolf tried to convince legislators to raise the broad-based taxes, as they call them here, the sales and personal income taxes, and that didn't get done. There was no sign that that was about to change, and so what we heard this week was a really different tone from the governor, as he, as opposed to last year when it was a pretty confrontational tone. This time, he really emphasized what the legislators and him have done together, and we heard, as you said, a lot of talk about reductions and deficiencies and not a whole lot about their obligation to raise taxes by a lot.
Sam?
Yeah, I mean, the only thing I would add, there's obviously a lot of components to it, like Karen was mentioning, but you know, there's also the gubernatorial race for next year that's already kind of kicking in gear that a lot of people have mentioned played a role probably in his strategy this time, especially dealing with a lot of Republicans in the House and Senate that, may be thinking about going for his job. So he was kind of combining, you know, the past 2 years of where he was stalled with these Republican legislators and also kind of the future of, what might work best with this new dynamic.
Sam, let me follow up on that one regarding next year's gubernatorial race. So does this push Wolf closer to the middle for all voters for a general, or on the other hand, does that push him away from a Democratic base?
I think there's no question this is going to push him more towards the middle. I think, you know, especially since we have not seen any Democrats from the Democratic Party in Pennsylvania come forward and say that they're going to challenge him. I'm not sure if he faces any kind of backlash for that middle ground, and especially because a lot of these things he's proposed have been well received by the Democrats as well. It's not just the Republicans that are on board with this. So I think really it's going to benefit him in the long run with this general election campaign. And it'll be interesting to see, especially now that Republicans are saying, this is something that they can work with in that general election coming up. Are they going to bring up the previous 2 years of the broad-based tax increase proposals that he, kind of had forefront on his mind?
Karen, did you get the same sense that there was a underlying message in here for 2018, not just a 2017 budget proposal?
Sure. I mean, well, I think that, the next upcoming election is always on the minds of the office holders here, whether it's the governor or the legislators. And I think, certainly those kind of calculations could have played a part in it. But, it's not like he had not tried previously without success to raise those broad-based taxes. And so I'm sure that all of these factors, played into it.
Okay, let's take a look at the budget involving expenditures, cuts, et cetera. Senate President Pro Tem Joe Scarnati said, yes, the cuts are needed, seemed to welcome the proposed cuts, but he said, quote, you have to reform the policies behind how we spend the money. So is it the policies or is it just the attitude that's taken toward expenditures in general? Sam?
Well, I think, the governor's office did admit that there's a lot of things in here that are one-time measures. A lot of the consolidations with the four health-related departments coming into one, reducing IT services in some department and some positions in departments, there's things that raise hundreds of millions of dollars that are really one-time things. But there's also some new revenue streams from, expanding sales taxes for certain business-related things and some other fees applied. We see the Marcellus Shale tax that he proposed again, which, faces some uncertainty there. But things like that, things like raising the minimum wage, that could be recurring. Things that, like the municipality fee for state police. So some of these things are underlying things that may be recurring, but I think the things that the Speaker in the House that you mentioned and some of the leaders in the Senate were also referring to were the big pension obligations that the state still has, and which Wolf's office did not propose any kind of real plan for in this budget. He has said he's willing to work with them on that, on those things, but that was on the forefront of the Republicans' mind when they looked at this week.
Right, and I want to get to that pension pension reform in just a little bit. One area of focus of any budget is funding for education. What's the governor proposing here? Any specific reaction to that from Republican leaders, from both of you? And let's start with Karen.
Sure. So this has, been a big priority for Governor Wolf, increasing state funding for education. In this budget, we have a request for increasing the main K-12 basic education funding line by $100 million, early education by $75 million, special education by $25 million. I did not hear a ton about that aspect of it from the Republican legislators, except, for acknowledgments that funding has been increased in those areas in the past couple years and some requests to take credit for that, for approving that, just as Governor Wolf would have credit for it, for calling for it.
Sam, did you hear anything about the proposals regarding education funding?
Yeah, I didn't hear a lot of resistance to it, like Karen was saying, especially probably because this was a smaller increase that he's proposed in previous years. It's only $100 million total for some of the things that Karen was mentioning, and less for higher education, too. So I don't think there was a lot of, immediate response to that. We did some stories here of some school districts responding, and, they're still concerned with, they're happy with the increases that Wolf proposed, but they're still concerned with some of those still underlying things that are increasing their budgets every year.
Yeah. And is there still concern, Sam, out your way, the funding formula, how money is distributed to school districts?
Yeah, the funding formula, I haven't heard anything about that this week necessarily, but I assume that's being implemented already. I could be wrong with that. But, the school districts are still concerned, absolutely, with the pension costs that are increasing, and health care costs and special education costs that are still going up every year. And they're still saying they have to eliminate, they may have to eliminate and reduce programs in schools, even with these increases over the last few years.
We're talking the Pennsylvania state budget proposal unveiled this week by Governor Wolf, totaling $32.3 billion. Our guests are Karen Langley, Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Post-Gazette, also Sam Janish, a political reporter for LNP, the daily newspaper in Lancaster County. You both mentioned the governor said no increases in broad-based taxes, but he did propose, I believe, about $1 billion in additional revenues. And you alluded a little bit to the severance tax and some other things. How is he suggesting doing that in addition to the severance tax, closing loopholes, expanding other taxes? Karen?
Sure. So a large portion of that, about almost half of that $1 billion in new tax revenue, would come from changes to the sales tax, extending that tax to various services that the administration describes as like business or corporate services, rather than something that you or I might go to the store and buy, things like custom computer programming, commercial storage, aircraft sales. Those categories together are supposed to raise almost $500 million if that were to be approved. There's also some changes proposed to taxes on insurance premiums and some corporate income tax changes that are suggested.
And Sam, you also alluded to earlier the severance tax. That's failed in the past. Is there any inkling that it would have a different future this time around?
Well, the short answer is no. We heard responses this week from the leader saying there's essentially no appetite for it again this year. And we were hearing that even before this week when the governor indicated he was going to propose this again. Now, with the proposal that came in this week, a 6.5% fee that would raise almost $300 million. Now, there's some indication that people are skeptical of that number, especially because the industry is still kind of rebounding from some of these low prices in the last few years. So, the industry itself, the Marcellus Shell Coalition and others, responded immediately saying, obviously they're opposed to this again. And while they're seeing some increases over the last few years for themselves, they're still going to be opposed to this. And it seems like it's going to be dead on arrival.
House Majority Leader Dave Reed indicated he thought that the estimates of the new revenues might be a bit high, but he said overall his caucus was cautiously optimistic about the budget plan.
There's obviously a lot of questions about his billion-dollar revenue package, but we're also very heartened by the fact that he took the time to put together $2 billion worth of cost efficiencies, spending reductions, mergers and consolidations.
To both of you, from the reaction that you've gathered, whether it's among lawmakers or citizens or businesses, are Reed's comments in sync with them or not? Sam?
Yeah, I think they are. I talked to several lawmakers this week who pretty much said the same thing. The first things out of their mouths were, this is a much better start than what we were last year. The tone and tenor of that address was much different. This time last year, I was having conversations with lawmakers saying that they were being lectured by the governor's budget address last year, saying that they really need to, focus on these new revenue streams and provide for education, all of his priorities. But the tone was much different, and I think they recognized that. And I think, a lot of the expectations going into this budget were that the stalemate would be a little bit longer than last year, and maybe even closer to the stalemate we saw the year before, in terms of time past the deadline that this budget's going to go. And I think the governor's address really kind of helped that idea and maybe reduce expectations about it getting a little out of hand this year again.
Karen?
Yeah, the tone of response from Republican legislators was certainly more tempered, more mild overall. While, you know, there still were certainly points of criticism, like with the natural gas tax proposal, overall, I would say that, you know, this is described from the Republican perspective as a more realistic proposal in their eyes than they had been presented with in the past couple of years.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman said he was disappointed the reforms weren't included for the pension system, and Sam, you brought this up. So is it needed to put the pension reform within the budget? Can't that be done separately in other legislation?
Yeah, it can be separate. And I actually asked the House Majority Whip, who is a Lancaster County representative, Brian Cutler, this week, if he thinks that pensions would hold up this budget agreement. I think in previous years we've seen there been some hesitancies to go forward with the budget proposals without a simultaneous pension plan alongside it. And he said that he thought at least that this pension issue was not going to hold up the budget. I think they are definitely going to be having to work on this side by side, though, for the next several months.
Karen?
The pension, you know, legislation, at least from, you know, the versions we've seen in recent years, is unlikely to have a major effect on the actual state spending for the next year. And so in that sense, it really doesn't need to go along with an appropriations bill at all. But I think that, you know, here in the Capitol, the state budget deadline every year is the pressure point, that provides a sense of urgency for legislators to get something done. And so if you are pushing a major issue like pensions that is going to be really difficult to get done, and it's going to involve a lot of wrangling, the budget and tying it to the budget presents an opportunity to extend that sense of urgency with the budget to your proposal that you're trying to push.
In our last minute, any other possible points of contention in this budget?
I think this was already mentioned, but the proposal...
minimum wage increase, I think, is going to be hard to pass, and the labor's indicated that this week, along with the shell tax, and I think there's going to be a lot of inspection into this. State police fee for the municipalities that use state police full-time.
And Karen?
The state police is just what I was going to point out, that I think we will hear from some rural communities saying that they can't afford this additional fee, and that, you know, perhaps they're not, in their eyes, actually getting that much coverage from the state police, as, you know, compared to a municipality that has its own local police force.
And we're going to be talking about the state police cheating scandal a little bit later in this show. And very quickly, I guess a one-word answer, we're going to have a budget on time. 2 years ago, it was into the new calendar year before we had a budget. Last year, we had one on time. Are we going to have a budget on time? Sam?
Probably not by June 30th.
Karen?
Possibly.
Okay, very good. Thanks to both of you. Karen Langley is Harrisburg Bureau Chief for the Post-Gazette. Sam Janish is political reporter for LNP, the daily newspaper in Lancaster County. Thanks to both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
A couple of Democrats are looking to challenge Mayor Peduto for renomination. What are his vulnerabilities? That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last Friday was the deadline for candidates to file for the endorsement of the Allegheny County Democratic Committee for the May 16 primary election. While the news and aftermath of the November election is still bubbling, we have another election coming up in a little more than 3 months. Joining us in studio, Chris Potter, reporter for the Post-Gazette. Welcome back, Chris.
Good to be here with you.
And Charlie Deach. She's the editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Charlie, good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, the primary is for the nominations and municipal contests, 4 city council seats, 5 Pittsburgh school board seats, Allegheny County Council, Common Police Court, of course, the top contest, the Pittsburgh mayoral primary. So I assume not to be as contentious as this past November's election, gentlemen?
Well, that depends on how unpleasant people are willing to be. But yeah, I suspect probably we will not see the pillars of the Republic crumbling this May. Yeah.
But there might be a few shots at one another?
Yeah, I think that's probably the whole reason Darlene is getting in, so she can take a couple shots at the mayor. How many shots depends on how much money she can scrape together between now and the time the race really gets going.
Darlene Harris, of course, the longtime Pittsburgh City Councilwoman, and also seeking the Democratic nomination is Reverend John Welsh. I'm going to get to them in just a minute. I'm going to go back 4 years when, of course, the incumbent was not seeking renomination and reelection, Luke Ravenstahl. 4 Democrats on the ballot at that time, and of course it was Bill Peduto, Jack Wagner, Jake Wheatley, and A.J. Richardson. Peduto received just a little under 52%. Wagner nearly 40%. Became a bit of a challenge. Wheatley 7.7%. A.J. Richardson, I think it was 0.6%.
Despite the power of a city paper cover.
Yeah. Right.
Yes. The old curse. It's just like Sports Illustrated for politicos.
But looking back, did Jack Wagner have a chance? Could he have done better if there had been a little more effort, a little more enthusiasm, maybe a little more money?
Well, I think actually maybe the biggest obstacle he had was he needed a little more time.
Because he did stall. He did stall.
Well, he was keeping out because, remember, there were a lot of questions about whether Luke Ravenstahl was actually going to run or not. And I remember on election night talking to Jim Furla, the former state senator and former city councilor, and he said the problem with this race was so much of who was holding the debates. You know, is these kind of progressive groups that were very much in line with Bill Peduto's, you know, overall agenda or whatever. And we just never were able, the landscape was already kind of shaped by the time we got into this thing. Who knows what would have happened? But I think Wagner probably was hurt by just the fact that he got into it late and he just didn't have the ability to kind of shape the race in the way that I think he would have needed. And two, I mean, you know, Bill Peduto ran a very credible campaign. So there's no guarantee that he would not have won that, obviously.
Charlie?
Yeah, it was kind of a strange, given the experience that Jack Wagner has, running for elected office, he didn't even have infrastructure, really proper infrastructure, ready for the first several weeks of that campaign. Trying to get a hold of his campaign, it was just almost impossible. So I think that was the that was a big problem as far as getting the late start. He just didn't have anything ready.
This too would be an issue for this year, especially if Ms. Harris does run. And I mean, Charlie mentioned, you know, it depends on how much money she gets. In a way, this campaign could be over within a few hours after folks hear us on the air, because essentially one of the first obstacles she has to clear is she has to come up with $10,000 to file for the endorsement, for the party endorsement to run for mayor. She has about $25,000 in her old city council campaign committee, but under Pittsburgh law, under Pittsburgh ordinance, you have to create a new committee for each race you run, and she can only transfer $5,000 from the old one. I spoke to Ms. Harris earlier this week, and I said, "You're going to be able to get $10,000 together by Friday at 5 p.m.?" And she said, "I guess we'll see." So if she's not able to do that, I don't know that she continues to campaign. You know, she has not formally announced. She's never held a big thing with balloons or even sent out a press release. You know, what she has told me is, "I am seeking the party's endorsement, and we're going to kind of see where it goes from there." So she may or may not be in this thing. It just sort of depends on how the next several hours go.
Yeah, you know, Charlie, she's been that way in the past,
yeah,
too. She sort of hinted, yeah, but never jumped in.
Yeah. Well, and last time, if I'm remembering back correctly, she made a half-hearted effort, and she actually got in some trouble with the party because she was a ward chair, and for going against the party nominee, she got in some trouble for that. And I know that seat means a lot to her. We weren't so – after it happened, maybe we thought maybe it didn't, but she really fought to get that seat back. I can't see her jeopardizing her role in the party to keep going.
Okay. Well, then let's talk about Reverend John Welsh. He, of course, is dean of students at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. This is an interesting guy. He was a Peduto supporter 4 years ago. Tell us a little bit more about him and why has the mayor fallen out of his favor?
Yeah, I mean, I think Reverend Welch lives in Homewood. He was a former president of the Pittsburgh Interfaith Impact Network, which is an organization that actually has also been supportive of Bill Peduto and part of sort of a constellation of progressive groups in town that have generally been supportive of his initiatives. When you talk to Reverend Welch, his concern is this city is changing very, very quickly. There's been a lot of development in places like East Liberty, not far from his own neighborhood of Homewood. And he's concerned that some neighborhoods are growing so fast that people can't afford to stay there, and some neighborhoods aren't improving at all. So he's sort of running on this kind of economic justice kind of campaign. I will say he is, you can tell he's a minister. I was at his campaign event, and he had a line in there, and it was saying, it's not fair that East Liberty looks like Monaco, whereas Beltshoover looks like Monaca, which is a good line, although I will say I got a call from somebody in Monaca who is part of the economic revitalization office up there, who was less than enamored. So it's a good thing he's not running for mayor up there in Beaver County, but he's a charismatic guy. And I think he's put his finger on some subjects that have been of concern for people here in terms of sort of where this city is going and who gets to be a part of that growth.
Yeah, Charlie.
Yeah, I think one of the things that endeared Bill Peduto to so many people was the fact that he was farther left. He was progressive. So how can you be different than that? I mean, nobody wants to see the Luke Ravenstahl type come back into office. But John Welch has a shot of getting a little farther left, especially on issues like affordable housing and gun violence and again, the economic justice stuff. He has a chance of getting even farther left than Bill Peduto, and that's going to play well with a lot of people.
The question is whether that translates. Does it become anything more than just sort of a complaint? Is he actually able to translate right. that into some sort of policy prescriptions? We haven't seen that yet. What he's doing right now is articulating a feeling that I've heard from other people, which is, the mayor got in, he talked a lot about affordable housing. It's not like the mayor was not cognizant of these issues. But where is the land bank exactly? You know, we have there's an affordable housing trust fund being created, but where's the money to fund it? Council is still trying to, you know, the council and the mayor is still trying to figure that out. There was some debate about it in council just this week. You know, so I think there's a sense of impatience about it.
I was just talking to the mayor about that, and he said, okay, we're ready, policy. Now the next step over the next couple few months is finding the money, the initial money to infuse, to buy and renovate and then hopefully sell.
And that's why I think in some ways, you know, this will be the test for Reverend Welch. Is he able to sort of pressure the mayor effectively to kind of move the ball on those issues? I don't know. You know, this is going to be some, you know, conventional wisdom here, and I apologize for it. It's very difficult to unseat an incumbent mayor in the city of Pittsburgh. You know, Luke Ravenstahl could probably have gotten reelected had he not chosen not to run. So does Reverend Welch pose a political threat to Bill Peduto? It remains to be seen. It's possible that he could pose a sort of philosophical threat, taking the mayor at his word for the way he ran in 2013 and saying, well, how have you delivered on that?
Here's my question, because I'll get to if there's any Republicans names floating out there. And it's been decades since a Republican mayor. But does Reverend Welch even have that leverage of, well, I might not win the endorsement. If I stay in, I might not win the nomination, but do I even have enough leverage to try to get the mayor to do something? So I'll support him, because does he even need my support to win against, against whatever fill in the blank Republican?
I don't think it's so much about the support. I think it's about if Welch can get in this race, and Bill Peduto has his weaknesses. He has his weaknesses. As Chris said, affordable housing, they've talked and talked, but we haven't seen any concrete action. We certainly haven't seen things get a whole lot better for people who have lost their homes in East Liberty and neighborhoods like that. And things like gun violence. I mean, Bill Peduto, before he was elected, he promised that he would enforce the city's lost and stolen gun ordinance. That was a no-brainer, because that was his and Doug Shields. That was their policy. To this date, not only has it not been enforced, he basically has said he will not enforce it. So
they're afraid of the lawsuit,
that's
the
exactly
money
right.
it would take to defend themselves.
But before he ran, he said, lawsuit or not, we're going to enforce this. And so Bill Peduto, there are some weaknesses there. And I think a lot of that comes from the reality of running for mayor and then the reality of being mayor. I think there's so much you can get done opposed to what you say you can get done. And I think that Bill Peduto hit some of those walls, but it's going to come back to haunt him, I think.
Okay, two-part question, gentlemen, and that is, is the party endorsement still important? And number two, are there any other names floating out there that aren't necessarily seeking the endorsement, whether it's a name that is fairly well known? I'm just throwing this out for an example. You know, in the past, city controller Michael Lamb has floated his name out there to run for mayor, et cetera. Are there any other names that are just saying, no, I'm not seeking the endorsement per se, but I might consider running?
I have not heard of anybody particularly who would be jumping in at this point. You can never be sure. Somebody out there maybe, you know, going around with petitions just to get themselves on the ballot for a vanity thing. It is very difficult, though, because, again, the challenge is sort of toppling an incumbent. If you don't seek the party endorsement, if you're getting into this race in February or afterwards, it is hard to see how you make any traction. So your question about the endorsement is a good one. The power of the endorsement depends a lot on the race you're talking about. If you're running for common pleas judge, there's plenty of anecdotal evidence, at least, to suggest you would actually rather have the Democratic Party's endorsement in Allegheny County than to have the Bar Association's highly recommended rating. It can be powerful in those races where people don't really know a heck of a lot about it. I think in some of these other races, especially in Pittsburgh, and especially in certain communities in Pittsburgh that are less kind of old school, kind of working class Democratic, you know, the effect is negligible.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, you brought up whether the mayor did not enforce the lost and stolen gun ordinance. I want to bring up another public safety issue with you. Any chance that the resignation of former police chief Cam McClay hurt the mayor?
I don't know that it's going to hurt him, because I think a lot of folks are willing to, because he got so much goodwill by putting Cam McClay in that seat, that I think people are willing to at least give Scott Schubert a chance. And so I don't think that will hurt him too much. I think there are issues of police accountability that will hurt him. He promised a more transparent system of, you know, when officers are involved in these kinds of incidents, high profile incidents. And I don't think we've seen that. We haven't really seen much change in the way that these investigations have been held. I mean, we have no idea what the final determination is on certain things. And so I think there are some issues where he's vulnerable. I don't think that McClay leaving per se is going to cause that big of a problem, but I could be wrong.
All right. So for both of you, let's say both or one, at least one of them, whether it's a Reverend Welsh or a Councilwoman Harris, let's just say both of them get the money, file the fee for the endorsement to try to win the endorsement, don't win the endorsement. Do either both stay in the race without the endorsement? And if so, which one?
I think it would be very difficult for Darlene Harris to remain in the race if she doesn't get the party's endorsement. Charlie kind of alluded to this before. It was an issue a couple of years ago. And she is, she is very, very firm about believing in seeking out the party's endorsement. I don't know, what does she run on then? I mean, Bill Beduto has more than $800,000 in her account. Darlene Harris, again, $25,000. So he's the incumbent. He has all of this stuff. What is her base to run without the support of the party? I don't know what it would be.
Charlie, let me take a phrase that Chris just used.
Yeah.
What would she run on? Not so much the money, but what would she run on in terms of an issue?
I mean,
or three.
I think one of the, I mean, just her main platform will be, I'm not Bill Beduto. And there are no checks and balances right now in city government. I mean, that's been one of her big things, is that council's sort of a rubber stamp. So, you know, I think that that's going to be her big platform is, you know, I'm going to bring transparency back. Darlene Harris, of all people, bring transparency, I guess. But because she's always seems to be a more, you know, definitely a more conservative member of council. So, yeah, I don't know. I think her biggest thing is I'm not Bill Beduto.
I think I think it's pretty clear that she would run very much in line with a sort of pro-police position.
Yeah.
She and the Fraternal Order of Police are, I could see a natural allegiance there, especially because they and the mayor have had a fairly stormy relationship in his first term. And I think you can just kind of look at how she acts on council, you know, and some of the criticisms she makes. You know, there's a lot of from her, this sort of if Luke Ravenstahl had done what we're doing here today, you all would be up in arms about it. So I think she will, based on what she says in council on a regular basis, she will sort of challenge the mayor on sort of his own rhetoric and things like that, and say, I'm actually the one upholding all of this stuff. Whether people would find that convincing or not, it sounds like Charlie wouldn't. I don't know, but I would expect that. I also expect the words bike lanes to crop up regularly and with a tone of derision throughout any campaign against Bill Beduto.
One other race. Go ahead, Charlie.
Yeah, I just want to – I don't have any issues, obviously, with Councilwoman Harris, but I think she's always tended to stay on that sort of – more traditional, moderate Democrat side, and really sort of, you know, she talks about alliances now, but she's been a big part of council alliances in the past. And so it all just seems a little, this is my issue now. And just like when she was progressive for 10 minutes, when she got the council presidency a few years ago, I mean, she aligned herself with a group that would get her the council presidency. And as soon as that was done, she broke from guys like Bill Beduto and Doug Shields. So it's a little up in the air, I think, where exactly she'd go.
All right, gentlemen, we have just a minute left. Chris, I know you're going to the Democrats' winter gathering.
Yeah.
What's expected here?
Well, a variety
of
things.
Who is it and what's expected?
So it's the state committee. It's the gathering of Democrats from across the state who go to the state committee a few times a year. This year, this is their gathering where they will endorse the candidates running for statewide judicial races at all three levels, Superior, Commonwealth, and Supreme Court. Governor Wolf will be speaking tomorrow night. And there will also be, no doubt, some talking about how the Democratic Party goes forward. This will be their first meeting since the November elections. And obviously, a certain amount of reflection is probably in order, I think, based on how that played out. So I think there's going to be a lot of talk about kind of, you know, what happened and where we kind of go from here.
Charlie, what would you look for coming out of that as far as where you go from here?
Yeah, I think there's probably going to be a lot of deciding, you know, kind of how Tom Wolf's going to move forward into his reelection campaign as it begins to come up on us. And so, yeah, I kind of look for just sort of how they can change and sort of win back some of the Democrats that they lost who maybe thought that the party wasn't doing the right thing in the primary with Hillary Clinton and so forth. And just how do they move forward from here, I think.
Chris Potter is a reporter who covers politics, among other things, for the Post-Gazette. And Charlie Deach is editor of Pittsburgh City Paper. Thanks to both of you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
The Inspector General's office has found evidence of cheating and misconduct at the State Police Academy. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last Friday, the Pennsylvania Office of Inspector General released a report that found evidence of cheating, problems with training and testing, and misconduct by instructors at the Pennsylvania State Police Academy. We're going to talk now about this with the two reporters who broke the story that led to that 11-month-long investigation by the Inspector General's office. Wallace McKelvey is State House reporter for Penn Live. Welcome, Wallace.
Hey, good afternoon.
And Dennis Owens is a political reporter and news anchor at ABC 27. In Harrisburg. Dennis, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Nice to be with you.
If you have a question or comment for our guests, please tweet us at WESA Confluence. State police requested the investigation last March 16th, I believe, less than about 2 weeks after your reporting, Wallace?
Yeah, that happened about a week after I ran a report where I talked to a number of the cadets who were dismissed from the academy after a cheat sheet was found there in December. The state police had conducted their own internal affairs investigation, and according to a lot of these cadets, they feel like they were treated poorly. There was an assumption that they were guilty, and the cadets kind of outlined for me that there was this kind of broader culture of dysfunction at the academy, wherein instructors were teaching to the tests and they were providing answers directly from those tests to the students. The tests themselves hadn't been updated in years, and the staff had kind of encouraged, you know, one graduating cadet class to hand down their study materials to the next. It was some of those things were confirmed by other state police staff members who I talked to. And in some of these cases, the tests that they were actually being kind of administering to these cadets hadn't been updated since the 90s. And that's something that the Inspector General's report confirmed.
Dennis, you work for two different media organizations. Was this a joint investigation on the two of your part, or did you do your own separate investigations and then reporting?
No, we work independently, though often cross paths. And I had gotten reports in initially breaking this story that it had happened the previous December, and that there was some discipline happening because some cheat sheets were passed on. But as I felt, Marcus, I don't know if you feel this way, but I felt much more comfortable about my reporting as I was reporting that there was some kind of a cheating scandal going on and people were being dismissed from the academy than now where we talk about this culture and I'm less clear that there was actual wrongdoing, or was this more of business as usual and the way things were done and almost a game of musical chairs and all of a sudden the music stopped on the certain number of cadets?
Wells, you want to chime in on that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And kind of the interesting thing that's happened here is, you know, after the Inspector General's report came out, the office, which investigates other state agencies, made a series of recommendations to change the academy and to kind of change some of the state police policies that enabled this to go on for so long. The state police, for their part, they accepted, I mean, I think most, the lion's share of these recommendations. For example, you know, the department has already restructured the kind of training apparatus. There's been a major turnover in staff at the academy. The tests themselves were changed pretty much immediately. They had already changed even before I ran that big investigative piece where I looked inside the academy. That had already changed. What's happening now is the state police is investing in a computer system that would allow instructors to immediately change and kind of reorder the test questions so they can't easily be taught to, and they can't be passed down from one class to the next. There's also going to be an analysis of the techniques and guidelines that are being imparted to instructors to use in the classroom there at the academy. But what's interesting is I spoke to Commissioner Tyree Blocker last week when this all broke, and he told me that, you know, from his perspective, there was an awful lot of complacency at the academy, and he vowed that this would no longer be allowed to exist. However, he was very hesitant to say that there's anything wrong with the culture of the academy or of the state police that allowed this to happen. And he also said that, you know, despite the findings of the Inspector General's office, all of the cadets who were either dismissed or resigned voluntarily from the academy, none of those cadets will be allowed back in.
Okay, so 36 cadets were dismissed or left from that 144th class. At least that's the numbers I have. We're talking about the cheating scandal at the State Police Academy and the report issued last week by the Office of Inspector General. I'm Kevin Gavin. This is The Confluence. Our guests are Wallace McKelvey, State House reporter for Penn Live, and Dennis Owens, political reporter and news anchor at ABC 27 in Harrisburg. Let's hear from Bruce Beamer. He was the Inspector General. He said one of the findings, same test year to year.
That particular issue in and of itself allowed for the ability of one cadet class to pass down information sometimes even as close as, you know, corresponding, you know, question and letter answer on multiple choice tests.
Now, you know, someone from one class or somehow getting the questions from one class to another, let's face it, that happens in college, we hear. It is cheating, not an effective way to teach, using the same test year after year. But your findings, guys, were not just limited to cheating. And Wallace, you used the term dysfunctional academy. So does it go beyond, how can I say this, just cheating?
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the people I spoke to, and this is kind of echoed in the Inspector General's report, say that this is much more than cheating. And a lot of this comes down to kind of what the guidelines were at the academy. And in essence, you know, the Inspector General found that there really were no uniform guidelines. You know, the instructors themselves, they spoke to 9 different instructors and asked them, how do you define cheating? Well, what's interesting is they got 9 different answers. Now, there are commonalities between them, but each of those 9 instructors had kind of very different answers on what they thought cheating actually was. And this speaks to what the cadets were telling me and what some of the staff members were telling me back in March of last year, that there is this kind of sense that, you know, the rising tide lifts all boats, that the cadets need to help each other through this process. And part of that in practice became a culture where one cadet class would hand down materials to help the next cadet class go through. And the instructors themselves kind of made every effort they could to ensure that their cadets were successful, even down to giving them the answers to the actual test that they were about to administer. And another example, and I touched upon some of this in my article, but the Inspector General's office dove a lot deeper than I was able to based on my sourcing. They found that, for example, with the medical exam that was being administered to these cadets, the instructors, if a cadet failed that medical test, a written exam, they would be readministered the test over and over and over until they passed it. And that's one thing, but in some cases, they would be given the same exact test over and over and over again. And that raises some questions in some quarters. You know, some of the people I talked to said, you do have to wonder how much the cadets who graduate and become troopers, how much have they internalized these lessons, and could this be problematic when they actually hit the road?
Dennis, I want to ask you.
Well, I was just going to say another part of the issue is there's some reality that the state police is undermanned, and there's a big balloon of retirements about to happen potentially, and they need some numbers and they need some bodies, and there are some people I've spoken with that are concerned that the standards have been lowered here. So you're right, it's not just cheating. Additionally, it's not just cheating. It's not like you're at the University of Pittsburgh or Carnegie Mellon out there where you are. It's not like a frat boy prank. These, you know, when you're in the state police academy, there's supposed to be a sense of honor and doing the right thing for the right reasons.
Well, let me follow up with you,
Dennis.
But
there's no question there's some people that were nailed in the cheating scandal that weren't even aware they were quote-unquote cheating.
Okay, Dennis, let me follow you up. So with that, what you just brought up, do you think this will hurt in trooper recruitment efforts and even the quality of the applicants?
Well, there are some people, some current troopers and some former troopers who insist that's absolutely happening, that the quality of the trooper will be reduced as a result. And in fact, that institutionally the state police is going through that right now, and they know they're lowering the standards, but they're doing it nonetheless. In the name of getting more people into the academy. You certainly would hope not. You expect that the state's troopers, which statewide has been kind of the gold standard of law enforcement throughout these many decades, that would be able to be maintained. But there are certainly questions about the quality of the cadets.
I have just 90 seconds left, gentlemen, like you both, to answer this. So probably the most important question, the cheating, providing answers in advance, questions about training procedures. How does all of that affect the quality of the cadets? I mean, these are officers coming out of the academy. They're supposed to protect the public and enforce the law justly. How is all this going to affect those two jobs? Dennis.
Well, I would say that now the microscope is on the academy, and I think that you would assume that since the microscope is on and people are looking and the Inspector General's report, that they would be headed in the right direction, or a better direction, I should say.
Wallace?
Yeah, I think only time will tell, you know, how the actual institution improves. From the larger cultural perspective, it doesn't seem like there's been any effort to look at past cadet classes. It's obvious that these practices have gone on for years, and I like the analogy that Dennis had of the music stopping on this class. But the Inspector General's office and the state police have not done anything to look into what past classes have done and how that impacts them on the road. Now, the commissioner would push back on that a bit. He says that, you know, that these guys, they go through training every year once they become troopers, and that a certain amount of the kind of important work that is done on the road. And a lot of the current troopers would say the same thing. I had state police staffer who obviously would only speak to me anonymously, but he said, you know, the academy is one thing, but it's a joke. You know, you don't expect to learn everything you need to know at the academy.
All
now,
right.
on the other side,
we're going to have to stop it right there. I'm sorry.
If you're learning on the road.
All right, Wallace. Wallace McKelvey is State House reporter for Penn Live. Dennis Owens is the political reporter, news anchor at ABC 27 in Harrisburg. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
And for this week, that's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Our engineer is Tom Hurley. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good week of good news.